This is the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast, episode 45. Good day and welcome to this episode of the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast. I'm your host, podcaster, and author of Fun Fantasy Reads, Jamie Davis. This podcast is exactly what the title says it is, folks. It's a show based on everything to do with anything having fantasy in the title of the book. I mean, if it's about fantasy, if it's written in a fantasy world, we want to cover it here. That means epic fantasy, urban fantasy, swords and sorcery, you name it, we've got the best and brightest authors from the various corners of the fantasy book world coming on the show to chat with me and give you some insights into what makes them tick. So I hope you'll check that out. We got some great guests coming up, including our special guest today. Before we get to that, though, just my personal update. I'm excited about the coming release of the Broken Throne 5-book urban fantasy series. That'll be coming out in just a few weeks on July 19th. I'm really excited about the way many of my author friends actually have reached out to me to help with the re-release of this series after I got the rights back from the original publisher about 6 months ago. So I'm excited about that. We're going to be releasing the books in rapid succession about 3 weeks apart. Book one will release on July 19th. So keep an eye out for that. The Charm Runner is the first book. The series actually is pretty exciting. I enjoyed writing it. It explores a world where magic is treated as illegal and becomes a black market product, sort of like alcohol did during Prohibition. And we have gangsters, crooked cops, really evil hero, bad guy. And all that is coming along pretty quickly here in just a few weeks. So if you're looking for a good summer read, I hope that fits the bill. As always, if you want to follow exactly what's going on with me, you can always do that by checking out my fan group over on Facebook at Jamie's Fun Fantasy Readers. Also, my page over there, Jamie Davis Books, and my blog and website, jamiedavisbooks.com. Okay, our guest for this episode is James Maxey, and I have to say, it's pretty funny that the description he sent in to me made me laugh. James's mother warned him if he read too many comic books, they'd warp his brain. According to him, she was right. Now he's an adult who can't stop daydreaming. But fortunately, daydreaming plus typing equals profit. James is the author of 20 books, mostly dragon novels and superhero novels. He's been a Phobos Award winner and was the 2015 Piedmont Laureate. Check out my chat with James. It's coming right up. James, I want to welcome you to the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast. It's really an honor to have you on the show today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I know a lot of people probably know who you are, but for those that may not, why don't you introduce yourself and tell them a little bit about yourself?
All right. So I'm James Maxey. I'm the author of numerous fantasy novels, the Bitterwood series and the Dragon Apocalypse series. I also write superhero novels. I've got two series there, the Lawless series and the Nobody series. And then I have some oddball stuff like short story collections and a Wizard of Oz novel called Bad Wizard.
Awesome. Well, I know we're going to be talking about Bitterwood a little bit in a few more minutes. But first off, just kind of tell us a little bit about how you came to be an author. Was this something you've done all for a long time, or is it something that you kind of started later in life?
So I think I started it fairly early in life. My mother warned me that if I kept reading all those comic books, they were going to warp my mind. And she was right. And so I kind of grew up into an adult that couldn't stop daydreaming. And eventually I found out that I could write down my strange fantasies and people would give me money for them.
It's a wonderful thing, isn't it?
It is. That said, you know, I didn't see my first book in a bookstore until I was 40. So it was a long apprenticeship.
it does take a little bit of time to kind of get it all worked out and come along. But, you know, I think everybody that told us the comic books were going to warp our brains back in the day, I have to just kind of laugh and point to the Marvelverse. You know, it seems like comic books did all right in the end.
Well, comic books did all right in the end. You know, they're still debatable as to whether you should spend your childhood reading comic books or, fine Russian novels. Or my new preference would be very big brick of fantasy novels.
Well, you know, I did a little bit of all of that, so I think I'm all right. Less of the Russian novels, but I'm an educator, so it is my belief always has been whatever I can get a kid to read that interests them will make them a reader eventually. I just have to get them to discover that there's a way into another world through reading. And whether that's reading sports biographies or if it's reading comic books, it's an opportunity to teach them that there's a way to get to another world through words.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, that's the whole point of fantasy literature. I mean, just as they say that you can't really know your own country until you've traveled abroad, you know, how are you supposed to know your own world if you can't travel abroad? And the only tool we have for doing that is literature.
Definitely. And so I know the Bitterwood series is about a time and age when dragons are ruling the world. And there's this person that is a dragon slayer for all intents and purposes. You want to tell us a little bit about the evolution of that story?
Yeah, so this will probably come as a shock, but I used to play a lot of D&D. And so I had I was DMing a campaign, and I had a ranger whose family had been slain by giants, and he was a NPC, and his name was Bitterwood. And around that time, I was like, you know, I should really write a fantasy novel. I'd been playing D&D for years, and my friends were like, why don't you write fantasy? You know, you do this all the time, and you're really good at the DMing. And so I liked the name, and I liked the tragic backstory of the family, you know, slain by giants. But I shifted it over to dragons. I just wound up keeping the name. And then another aspect of Bitterwood, and feel free to discuss this, I do not regard as a spoiler, is that the world is actually a science fiction universe. So it's, it's more or less hard science fiction, just in a fantasy disguise. And that came about from these, after the D&D games, we would sit around and talk about, you know, wouldn't it be great if there was like a Jurassic Park, but with fantasy animals, and you could actually go and hunt like these genetically engineered dragons and, you know, unicorns and hippogriffs. And, so I took that idea and I thought, what could possibly go wrong with creating intelligent carnivores to capable of killing men? And so that's where I came up with with the idea of these very intelligent, very social animals that, you know, could eventually conquer and enslave mankind.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned you were a DM. I mean, I think of authors that I've interviewed and talked to, it seems like one of the more common themes is this background of GM, Dungeon Master, Game Master, as maybe a potential training ground for making good story development. And I have to think it's because when we did that or do that, we are having to think on our feet, and we are having to watch the effect of our story in real time.
Exactly. You also have to be completely willing to let characters be themselves. And so, you know, one of my better traits as I grew as a DM was, you know, I would start with these very carefully plotted adventures and these very carefully designed dungeons and stuff. And, you know, I really needed my characters to hit certain beats in the story in order for the story I had planned to work. And in the early years, I'd get frustrated when the characters would go off and go on tangents and do their own things. And I was constantly having to, you know, steer them back into the story. And eventually I really learned to just trust the characters and that it was a cooperative, you know, storytelling. And I still very much have this approach. I'm not an outliner. I'm very much a pantser. And for me, you know, there's this, you know, kind of a pseudo mysticism of the characters kind of become a living, living beings. And they tell me what they're going to do and they tell me how they're going to react. And I'm just, you know, recording them.
Absolutely. And isn't that the joy? Isn't that the joy of the writing experience for a person who is a mostly a pantser? I am as well. I mean, I outline some, but it's really a, you know, a sentence or two to keep me on track. It's not anything that confines the story in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I will have certain beats that I'll write down or, you know, little bits of dialogue that come to me that are in no way appropriate for where I'm at in the story at the moment. And so, you know, I'll have a stack of 3x5 cards on my nightstand by my bed and, you know, they sort of form an outline. But the reality is that 90% of the time, once I write something down, I never look at it again. If it's a good idea, then it will come in, you know, it'll stick with me. And if it's not good enough for me to remember it 6 weeks from now, when I finally get around to writing that scene, it wasn't good enough to start with.
So I'm curious as a pantser, because I've seen a couple of different types of pantser authors. There are those who start with the like ending of the story firmly in mind, like they know this climactic scene and that's what they want to get to. That's their destination, but right. They have no idea how they're going to get there. So they pants from that end of the story. And then I know that there are other authors who start with this premise for a setting, and a situation. It's almost like a situation comedy type setup where you have X is going to happen in this place. What will be the reaction of these characters in this setting? And they come at it from the other direction where they don't necessarily know the destination in mind. Do you fall in somewhere in that spectrum or one or the other?
So I normally will start a book with a final solution in mind, an end condition. And almost always I will be 5 chapters from the end, and I realize that the ending I've been working for will not work at all. and I have to toss it out and do, you know, what my characters are now going to permit me to do. So I think of the 4 books currently in the Bitterwood universe, you can most see in the first book, Bitterwood, I knew that, you know, Bitterwood and the King of the Dragons would have to have this big climactic fight. And there was never any doubt, you know, that's where it had to go. And I had to, you know, I can see the outline whenever I read that book. I didn't actually have an outline when I wrote it, but it still has a very conventional structure, I feel like. But then once I got to the second and third books, Bitterwood is still a very important character. And there's a sorceress character named Jandra who follows over from the first book that I really had designed to be the lead character for the next book. But I introduced a fairly minor character, I thought, called Burke the Machinist, that then went on just to completely dominate the plot of the second and third book. And he was, you know, he enters the second book like in chapter 10. You know, he was really kind of a plot convenience. You know, I needed someone with a little bit of technological know-how, and, you know, he wound up just kind of taking over, you know, the War on the Dragon plots, and he kind of took that role from Bitterwood, and I think was a much better, you know, character and a much better fit for me, just stepping back and letting him be Burke.
No, and it's so much fun when the characters dictate to you after you've started to flesh them out, and they take on that personality of their own. And that instant, that moment when they do something completely surprising. And when you try to explain that to someone who's not an author, they look at you like you're hearing voices, and you know, you're psychotic or something.
Right. And you know, the Bitterwood is, you know, he's sort of Batman with a bow and arrow that's not Green Arrow, but, you know, but he really works well whenever he's lurking in the shadows and shows up at the last second to kill the dragon and then fades back in the shadows. He's kind of a difficult character to stay inside of his head for too long. But then, you know, once Burke came on the scene, you know, he was just all introspection. You know, he never makes a decision that he isn't, you know, thinking about for, you know, constantly and second guessing himself. And, you know, this sort of capacity for doubt and introspection, I think, made him an easier character to frame the story in and to address some of the philosophical questions, because there's just some questions that Bitterwood can never ask himself without his whole worldview falling to pieces. whereas Burke has the intellectual capacity to live with his contradictions.
And isn't it interesting to have that hero with a certain fragile nature themselves?
Oh, definitely. I only write about broken people. The worst book I ever wrote in the first draft was included in the Bitterwood collection as the fourth book. It's called Dawn of Dragons, and it's the prequel novel that's set 1,000 years before the rest of the Bitterwood trilogy. And when I wrote the first draft of it, the hero was a competent secret agent, CIA agent named Chase Morgan, who was really good at everything. You know, he was a computer hacker. You know, he was deadly at martial arts and, you know, could fire any gun, drive any, you know, fly any aircraft. And, you know, I really want to try writing one of these kind of James Bond characters as a hero, because so many of my heroes to that point had been less than heroic. And so I actually wrote an entire novel called Dawn of Dragons with this hyper competent CIA agent at the helm, and it sucked. It had no life, no character in it. You know, it felt very much, you know, like a puppet theater. And you know, the smartest thing I ever did was going back to page one and typing the whole thing over again with a new protagonist named Alex Pure, who is the least heroic character I've ever put on page. You know, he's a dishonest drug addict, you know, who's now a zombie because of, you know, some unethical stuff that he's done. And he's got very little in the way of a strong moral center. And yet, you know, I just enjoy every moment of writing him. You know, he's just someone who's, you know, you can count on him to make the wrong decisions again and again. and yet somehow it will all work out. There's an underlying heroism to him after all.
You know, it's funny you mentioned James Bond characters because, you know, that it's that especially, and I think you're of an age to understand this with me, which is the concept of Connery versus Moore, right? You know, the Roger Moore Bond versus the Sean Connery Bond. And I actually read Ian Fleming's Bond books and found that he was much more flawed than the movies portray him. He got that crap beat out of him all the time. And Connery represented that grittier Bond than Roger Moore, whose hair never got messed up, you know?
I assume you've read Goldfinger.
Yes.
I mean, Bond in that book is utterly incompetent from page one to the end. There's not a single positive action that he takes to stop the villain's plans. He instead, the whole thing is him stumbling on to plots, getting kidnapped by the villain who then, you know, in the cliche, confesses every secret that he has instead of just shooting Bond. I don't remember why he keeps Bond alive, but he's going to use Bond as part of his master plot. He winds up using Bond like a secretary. He needs a secretary for a meeting. And so he's like dictating notes to Bond. It's just like, this is a hero. How? And then, you know, and then I don't know if you remember, but Bond closes out the book with this horrible homophobic rant about how women are emasculating men and, you know, turning men into homosexuals.
I don't remember that, but maybe I glossed over it.
Yeah, no, it's there.
I've got to go back and read it. Well, you know, and I think it's those stories. It was more about Bond getting out of trouble than getting into solving anything, getting anything done. I mean, it was more about him, like you said, stumbling into a situation that he then, because of his own screw up, had to find a way out of.
Yes. There's never, especially in Goldfinger, you know, it's, you know, so there's a thing in Bond movies where, you know, he'll always have like a CIA agent or, you know, another member of the British intelligence. And there's always going to be a scene where the army or someone shows up with helicopters and, you know, rescues him from some dire situation. Or, you know, are the soldiers rappel in to take apart the villain's, you know, headquarters at the last second. And, you know, that's very much, you know, from the books, you know, it's just, you know, he's there to be abused and confused for the whole book. And then someone will come in at the last second and save him.
Well, I've always lamented that, you know, Felix Leiter didn't get his own series, right? I mean, in all of his iterations, you know, his, you know, multicultural and everything else. You never knew what Felix Leiter was going to look like next, but just a great story. Well, you know, it's just funny that you talked about that because, I mean, we can talk about spy thrillers alongside fantasy books because that concept of a flawed hero, that concept of, you know, what makes tension happen in a good story is the same.
Right. I will also say that, you know, I've read a lot of fantasy, but I can sometimes pick up a fantasy novel and tell that the author reads nothing but fantasy novels. And for me, they're never quite as satisfying as a fantasy novel that seems to be informed by other bodies of literature. The ability to mash up multiple genres instead of just regurgitating Tolkien again and again.
Well, and like you said, I haven't yet started your books, the Bitterwood books, but I plan on doing so. They're in my to be read file. I love the concept that it's actually hard science fiction disguised as fantasy because, you know, there is so much crossover happening right now. We've got space mages, and we've got, you know, we've got these situations like yours where there's actually a scientific reason for the fantastical things that are happening in the story.
Right. And, you know, a lot of, you know, magic should be, if you're going to use magic, you've got to have limits to it. And why not go ahead with the limits imposed by the laws of physics and biology? I'm already familiar with those. It didn't require as much much daydreaming.
Right. And space dragons and all the other things. There can be an explanation for how they exist and how they apply to a science fiction setting, just as you can say how science applies to a fantasy setting. I know when one of my series, part of the series, it's two trilogies that take place at different time frames, and the change in how magic works is directly affected by the advancement of the advent of gunpowder. That it's somehow altered the ability of magic to be as functional because science has started to take precedence. And I've liked exploring how magic can be broken. So that's been something I've had a lot of fun with.
Okay. Without saying too much, the introduction of gunpowder is a huge part of the Bitterwood series as well. When the novels in the first book, humans have lost the secret of how to make gunpowder. It's by the third book, in the original cover, there was a man with a shotgun on the cover. So it was a major change in the balance of power between dragons and humans.
Oh, I can imagine. I mean, the concept of, you know, dragons would not want humans to have high velocity projectile weapons. I mean, that would seem to me to be, you know, dragons would want to have that control.
Right. So in the Bitterwood universe, the humans went through some, it wasn't just the dragons dominated them. Humans had some bad luck with environmental and economic collapse, whether you want to regard that as luck or just, some consequences. And there was some, in the books, I refer vaguely to like the ninth plague that really winnowed the human civilization down to a fairly small number that then the fairly small number of dragons that existed could overtake them. But one of the biggest dominance that dragons have in warfare in my universe is that they control the sky. They are not fire breathers. They don't have any advanced weapons. But if you can fly above human lines at a quarter mile up beyond the range of any longbow, and you carry a bucket of darts and just dump that bucket down that line, you just completely, wipe out the human defenses. And so, the ability of dragons to fly over humans and drop things is very important. And in the new series I'm writing, Dragon's Gate, which is continuing in the Bitterwood universe, it will look at the implications of, okay, now humans have gunpowder, but dragons are going to get their hands on it too. And, they still have the ability to fly and humans don't. And so what's it going to be like, once the dragons have access to not just dropping shrapnel, but to actually dropping bombs. So it will be I'm really leaning into the science fictional elements in the next series.
Awesome. I'm glad you transitioned, because that was where I was going next, was, that I know you're working on a new trilogy in this series. What's the progress on that? Because I know they aren't out yet. What are you looking at as far as release times?
So, since I'm not working with a publisher on this one I'll be putting out myself, indie publishing it. The original Solaris series came out, or the original Bitterwood trilogy came out through Solaris Books. But I mentioned I also write superhero novels. The original publisher for the superhero novels went out of business years ago, and so I had released those books as ebooks and was suddenly selling very well with those. And so it came to a point where I could have continued. I actually was Solaris was interested in doing a collection of my actually my Dragon Apocalypse novels. And I was like, you know, I don't want to tie up the ebook rights any longer. I really would like to get those rights back. And so this new series will be coming out entirely independently published. So it'll be available on Amazon and eventually all platforms. It'll also have print editions. I actually sell quite a bit in print, far more than most authors, most indie authors, I believe. Anyway, this is a long-winded answer to say I don't yet know.
That's okay.
My original plan, I've got the first draft of the first book finished. My original plan was to have the book come out by this July at SuperCon, which is one of my bigger events of the year. But I'm going to miss that deadline. So there's a GalaxyCon in Louisville that will likely be my second biggest event of the year, and that's in November. So I'm still very plausibly could have it released by then. That said, I'm also giving serious consideration to not even releasing the first book until I write the entire trilogy. I'll be making that decision before the end of the year, obviously.
Yeah. And I got to say that there's a lot to be said for doing that. I've done that in the past, written an entire trilogy or even four or five books, before releasing them, so that I can kind of put them out in rapid order. And there's something to be said for that as an indie publisher to follow that kind of, game plan. So I think you're right on target there.
So the rapid release is a, obviously a good strategy. On the other hand, this is effectively book five or possibly book six of a series. There's also a short story collection called Dragonscape Preludes and Omens that's out that's also set in the Bitterwood universe that sort of bridges between the events of the first trilogy and this next trilogy, and that's already available. And since I've already got an existing fan base, it's quite possible that if I release the book this year, it's going to have just as many sales as it would if I delay it. And if I wait another year before I put out the second book and another year before I put out the third book, that's really, before the advent of indie publishing, what's very much the publishing schedule of most novels.
And there are a lot of indies that publish that way and are very successful. So, welcome to the world of indie publishing. There's no right or wrong way to do this. I affirm your choice to go either direction because, especially if you have an existing, existing reader base, that you can release to, you can have a lot of success doing spread out releases too. And I know people that do both ways and swear by it. And the only thing I've ever been able to tell anyone at this point is, learn what works best given your own set of circumstances and try to apply the rules to what you specifically have in place.
If these were, a lot of indie novels are shorter works. So I know a lot of people who release something 45,000 words long and call it a novel. And I would say the average indie book is probably 60 to 80,000 words. And my epic fantasies are always at a minimum 110 and some, edge up closer to 140,000. The whole releasing three books a year at that size is
a skill that I do not possess.
Well, and not only is it a skill, but it has so much to do with the way you write and your process, and that's such a unique thing to every single author that, like I've said many times to people that have said, well, what's your writing advice? Well, my writing advice is practice and try different things until you find what works for you, because you can try to do what I do and maybe it works for you and maybe it doesn't, but what works for me now didn't work for me 2 years ago and may not work for me 2 years from now. So it's a constant process, I think.
Yeah. And I still, so I do, writing is my full-time job now. And that is one of the great benefits of indie publishing, is once you're off the publisher's royalty schedule, if you have a traditional publisher, you are likely seeing two paychecks a year and many years, no paychecks because of the way that royalty structures work. You'll get a royalty, a fairly large amount in one lump sum if you sign a deal for a trilogy. But then depending on the way your contract is structured, until that trilogy advance earns out, you won't see any more. And so even if the first book is earned out, if that third book has not yet been released, you're just waiting around. You're not getting paid anything. And so the nice thing about an indie publisher is the day the book is released, you see the income coming in and you're paid on a monthly basis. One aspect of my career that not everyone does is I more or less tour constantly. I've become kind of a gig musician of as a writer, to where, at least three weekends a month, I'm at comic book conventions or science fiction conventions, selling my books directly. It works. It's a good source of revenue. The online sales are still, a huge part of my strategy. But keeping my back catalog, when I go to one of these conventions, I set up my table, I've got over 20 books that I'm selling. I have my own little bookstore, and things I wrote, 15 and 20 years ago still sell just as well as stuff that I'm writing today. So it's really a good way of keeping that back catalog active. Whereas with ebooks, I find that it's more the most recent release is, going to be your strongest seller, and you're kind of constantly having to leverage, or you have to advertise and do more cost promotions on your older stuff to keep it moving.
And I gotta say, I do two events a year and I really enjoy them. I actually sell pretty well at these events, but I go to them mostly because I enjoy just kind of getting face to face with readers. And there are certain people now that I've been doing this for a few years that look forward to me coming back to their community, and come by the table to say hi and sometimes bring books they've bought just so that I can sign the books they already bought on Amazon or wherever, which is kind of neat. But you're doing this, like you said, three weekends a month, that's gotta be really cool to see the readers that on that frequent a basis. It is.
And one of the nice things, all the years that I was with a mainstream publisher and felt so much in the dark about what a good cover was, what a good blurb was, I wasn't really good at knowing what it was about my own writing that people responded to. And the nice thing about doing these events is I can watch people walk past the table and I see the eyes fix on a certain cover.
you know, so I've definitely got, you know, I've been through, the Bitterwood cover is one that I actually paid for the rights from the original publisher. I paid the artist to keep that original cover. I think it's a very effective cover. I think it sells the book. And I actually, the cover for the first novel is now the cover for the collection. And so I sell a ton of those. I paid a Hugo award-winning artist to do a cover for my Dragon Apocalypse collection. It just, you know, I frequently sell out of it at events. And, you know, if I find that I have a cover that people aren't glancing at, I know I need to change it. And that's something with traditional publishing, you really didn't have the option of changing a cover. Whereas I update covers all the time. And, you know, if I have a cover I feel like is underperforming, I now know, you know, I know what works for other things. I've also learned, you know, I used to take 10 minutes to explain a book. And now I can pitch any of my books in like 25 words or less.
It's right, because you only have a limited amount of time. When they come by the table, you've got to be able to say, when they look at a book, you've got to be able to pick it up and hand it to them and give them that quick pitch. This is about this.
As an author, it is aggravating and humbling to discover that pitching the character means almost nothing. I used to be very character centric in my pitches. And now, for Dragon Apocalypse, I go right to D&D. I say it's very much like a D&D game. The characters are on a quest. They have to crawl through the dungeon, stab the monsters, and take their stuff.
That's great.
And then for the Bitterwood, I just say, it's post-apocalyptic. It's sort of Jurassic Park meets Planet of the Apes meets Tolkien.
Oh, that's great. That's fantastic. And,
you know, again, I don't explain who Bitterwood is. I don't talk about the King of the Dragons. I will, you know, tell people that there's no magic in it, that anything that appears magic is science fiction based. And it's really these high level premises that people latch onto. And then they can read the back cover or open it up and read the first page. I know, you know, if people open my books and read the first page, you know, I've got them.
That's great. No. And you know, that's the advantage you have from having that regular contact. You're like you've got to essentially have a storefront. You are the shopkeeper and you know what sells.
Exactly. This is not a career path that was available 20 years ago. I know that people went and did a lot of bookstore events and stuff 20 years ago, or, you know, longer. That was the traditional path. And when I first, you know, my first book came out in 2003. It was the superhero novel, Nobody Gets the Girl. And I did a signing at a Barnes & Noble in New York and, you know, had a crowd of 20 people that came out for that. And, you know, I would do them in, you know, more local areas. You know, I did some in, you know, Raleigh and Durham and Charlotte and Greensboro. And, you know, I literally would go to some events and two people, you know, would show up. And, you know, whereas I go to these comic book conventions, you know, SuperCon in Raleigh, is probably going to be, you know, very close to 100,000 people, you know, coming out for that weekend to pass through. And very few of them are coming there to see me, but there's a whole lot of geeks there who will see pictures of dragons and superheroes on my books and will stop and go, this looks like the kind of stuff I read. You know, connecting with my crowd, you know, these are my tribe. It's always very energetic. And, you know, while I say that very few people come there to actually see me, at SuperCon last year, you know, William Shatner was one of the guests. Dave Bautista from Guardians of the Galaxy was there. You know, so just all these A-level, you know, stars, and the doors open at 10,
And at 10:05, there's a guy at my table, you know, saying, you know, oh my God, I saw you on the guest list. I just had to come and get everything, you know, everything I haven't, I read by you yet. You know, and so we bought a bunch of books.
And that made your whole trip, didn't it?
Like, yeah, you know, this is great. That's happened several times where I've sold a book at one event. They come again the next year and, you know, buy out, you know, everything else. And so it is, you know, customer satisfaction and repeat business helps. And I feel very fortunate. I'm not sure where you're based out of, but
I'm near Baltimore.
Okay. Well, you're actually in a really good area then for cons.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Oh, yeah. So I actually envy you then because there's some cons in that area, like Awesome Con, I would love to do, but the cost of hotels, but between the cost of the table, the hotel, and you know, parking garages in the $50 a day range, you know, there's no way I could haul up enough stock to sell to make a profit for it. So I actually, you know, feel lucky to be living here within a 2-hour drive of Charlotte and, you know, very close to Raleigh, very close to Greensboro, Richmond, Virginia Beach, you know, a lot of mid-sized cities, you know, all within a short drive for me. And there's, you know, literally, you know, an event every weekend I could pick from. You know, so, you know, I've talked to some other authors, you know, who are living out in Utah or someplace that, you know, they don't have the option of a con every weekend within driving distance. And, you know, but I would, you know, you're in a good spot because I know, Baltimore has a good science fiction scene.
They do. And Philadelphia does. I'm right about midway between Baltimore and Philly. The two cons I go to actually are, I have a local con here and I'm in a rural area, but it draws people down from Delaware and up from Baltimore. It's a surprising number of people for being where it is. And, it's small enough that I'm one of the few authors that actually attends this place. So I get a lot of traffic, just people are looking for books. And I happen to be one of the three or four tables that have books. So it's kind of nice. And then I go down to Ocean Cities Con on the eastern shore of Maryland, down at the beach. And that's good. That's in December.
Oh, okay. I'll look into that. Ocean City sounds more, it sounds like an affordable area.
Oh, yeah. It's at their convention center there, and there's, you know, it's free parking. And, you know, the hotels, it's off season. So you can get a room. You can get a room for the night for like $50.
Right.
It's not bad at all.
I doubt they'd even take me at some place like New York Comic Con, you know, where I'd get, you know, exposed to really huge crowds. But again, you know, I write big books and, you know, so I've got a convention tomorrow, this weekend, Heroes Con. And, you know, I've got 6 cases of books. This is probably, you know, very close to 300 pounds of books that I'm going to be carting in tomorrow. You know, I'll be able to drive in and just a trunk, you know, have it in trunk and back seat of a car. But to go to some of these really big cons, I would need like a van.
Right.
And just, you know, so many books in order to make a profit that it becomes problematic.
I'll send you the link to the Ocean City one just in case you're interested, just so you have it. I think they haven't sent out anything about this year's con yet. So they're still taking, like, you know, put your name on the list and we'll get in touch with you kind of thing. So
December is a good, so I say I do 3 a month. That is mainly during, spring and summer. There's definitely a drought of cons between November and February. The events that happen then tend to be a little bit smaller. So for me, the heavy con season, March, April, May, and June are all pretty heavy for me. And then SuperCon in July. But if I only got 2 events in July this year. So,
Yeah, I'll definitely send that to you, and we can maybe we'll run into each other there. That would be fun. James, listen, I'd love to chat with you some more, and maybe what we can do is when this next trilogy is ready to come out, and either as a single book at a time or in rapid release or however you decide to do it, get you back on the show and let's talk about the next series and some of the cons you've been to since.
All right. Sounds good. I thank you for having me.
And that will wrap up this episode of the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast. I want to thank you for checking out the show, and make sure you check up with us to get more episodes and find out more about what we're about by checking out the Fantasy Focus community group over on Facebook or our website at fantasy-focus.com. Leave a comment in this episode page over on the website if you want, and let me know what's on your mind, or ask a question of the author, and I'll make sure they get back and answer it for you. Also on the website, on each podcast episode post, you'll find links to subscribe to the show on your favorite mobile app for iOS, Android, and even by email. Make sure you do that so you don't miss any of the episodes. We have awesome authors coming up. We have E.G. Stone, Joe Jackson, and more already scheduled in the next few months, so don't miss out on anything that's coming up. That's it for this episode of the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Jamie Davis, author of Fun Fantasy Reads. Don't forget to follow me over on Facebook, Jamie Davis Books, and at my website, jamiedavisbooks.com, where if you're interested in checking out something I've written, you can get a free book just for signing up for my newsletter. Whatever you do, though, you want to make sure you subscribe and come back here for the next podcast. In the meantime, I'll remind you, just like I always do, to keep your eyes open, folks, because there's magic all around you.